Security.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Miriam Garrity, and I represent the plaintiff. Your Honors, this is a case in which the plaintiffs were penalized by defendants as a result of their association with a political figure of the opposing party. The cost of that affiliation was their abrupt termination from protected positions at the clerk of the circuit court. Because of their affiliation with the former clerk, Pachinski, they were regarded as Republicans who would not be loyal to the Democratic clerk. In that way, Clerk Brown was allowed to command the results which she couldn't command directly, condition the employment at the clerk's office on plaintiff's forfeiture of their First Amendment rights. Plaintiffs produced direct evidence of Brown's political motivation, which the district court erroneously disregarded. Plaintiff Fahey Wallenius was told by Clerk Brown's second-in-command, Squire Lance, that she was terminated because both Lance and Clerk Brown thought she was a Republican whose loyalty and political allegiance was to the former Republican clerk. Lance told Fahey Wallenius her termination was purely political, and she was replaced less than 3 weeks later by a campaign worker for Clerk Brown. Lance, who chaired Brown's campaign for the circuit court spot, was initially in charge of human resources at the clerk's office. All new hires had to be specifically approved by him. And Brown specifically asked Lance to handle Fahey Wallenius's appeal from her termination. He also attended 2 out of the 3 termination meetings with the other plaintiffs. His statement that because of her association with a Republican clerk, she wouldn't be loyal to Clerk Brown is direct evidence of Brown's animus. There's no stray remark or mere speculation as suggested by the district court, but in fact came from a person who was probably Brown's closest confidant with specific human resources responsibilities and who probably participated in the decision to get rid of the plaintiff. This case is on all fours with this court's decision in McColney, in which the defendant's senior citizens liaison told plaintiffs they were being terminated for political reasons. And it's unlike Nelms, in which the statement was, you understand political realities. This statement connects the animus with the termination.
I want to clarify a couple of things. One is the jobs themselves that they occupied ultimately. Were they transferred into those shortly, I guess you call those non-exempt or something?
That's correct.
Yeah, into a non-exempt job or civil service or something or other that's not political, not at will or however we label it. In the old days, it just says political, and you're out of here. But that was before Rutan, I guess. So the question is, were they transferred into those jobs just because it was sort of a safe harbor when they were actually part of the policymaker for, what's her name, Pachinski? Pachinski, thank you.
The answer is no, and there's a slight distinction in the plaintiffs. I mean, Fahey Wallenius has held her job more than a year prior to the change in administration.
Weren't they exempt non-career service employees right before the election, and then they got switched to career service employees right before the election?
They're 2 out of the 3 plaintiffs' jobs changed, yes. And what happened is, in the record, is Clerk Pachinski said to Bravos and Diaz, look, I'm running for election, you're in the executive office, and you won't be able to stay here. If there's a job that you can find and qualify for in the clerk's office, by all means, go ahead and do it. And by the way, these circumstances did not supply the basis of Brown's decision to terminate him. She said that the transfer of the plaintiffs from one job to the other had nothing to do with her decision to let them go. But that's what happened. There was a recognition that a new administration was coming in, and they wouldn't be able to stay where they were, at least Bravos and Diaz.
Because those were more policymaking or confidants? Or
with regard to Diaz and Bravos, they were in the clerk's executive office. Diaz had been the executive confidential secretary to Clerk Pachinski prior to taking on her new duties.
Well, if we consider them career service employees, which I'm not saying that they are, what statute or ordinance or contract or what guarantee are you relying on that shows that their employment should have continued or that if they were terminated, they should have had some kind of hearing, or it could be a hearing without cause. What are you relying on?
The rules and regulations.
Still a protected property interest.
The rules and regulation of the clerk's office, which are in the plaintiff's short appendix, provide for protection for career service employees. In addition to that, Clerk Patinsky testified that under her administration, career service employees could only be terminated for cause. And the plaintiffs understood that. And in fact, it had, you know, something to do with the decision of Brazos and Diaz to take those new jobs, because they knew that they could only be terminated for cause.
Was that because of her executive's decision, or was that something in the law or in a statute or something that gave them that protection?
Her testimony, Clerk Patinsky, is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Her testimony was that it was her practice and her belief that her rules provided that career service employees could only be terminated for cause.
And why would that have to hold over to Brown?
There were no change in the rules.
Well, what rules? Who made the rules?
The rules were developed in the Patinsky administration. Brown adopted the same rules that the Patinsky administration had, made no changes in them. And the property interests attached when the plaintiffs had a legitimate expectation of continuing in their jobs. They had that legitimate expectation because Clerk Patinsky indicated they could only be terminated for cause, and because a reading of the rules says that as well, Your Honor. The rules basically divide employees into two categories, exempt non-career service and career service. The rules say exempt non-career service employees are at will.
But isn't the problem that the rule book does not create a contract that then gives them a protected property interest? Doesn't the handbook specifically disclaim that it is creating a contract? And if it's not a contract, they don't have a property interest.
There is a disclaimer.
Isn't that a problem for you?
It's a problem, but it's not insurmountable, as this court has said in other cases. The disclaimer is contradictory with the balance of the rules and regulations. And since the rules and regulations, as I said, indicate that only exempt employees are at will, the clear implication is that non-exempt employees are not at will, and there must be, therefore, some substantive limitation on the clerk's ability to.
But that's something you're reading into it. It doesn't specifically say
that.
Not
specifically.
Right. That's your.
That's right.
Sort of speculation or your extrapolation of what it means, but that's not what it says.
It's not what the rules say. Another thing the rules do that I think impose limit on the clerk's ability to get rid of career service employees is that they specifically reserve the clerk's ability to terminate career service employees under certain specified circumstances.
It talks about disciplinary actions, but it doesn't. There's no limitation on the clerk's ability to terminate career service employees with or without cause, other than the reference to disciplinary. Right?
Well, the rules don't specifically say that. What I'm saying is the rules specifically, though, reserve to the clerk the right to get rid of career service employees in certain circumstances, which were not present here, a reorganization of the department, of budgetary reasons, other reasons. There's no reason to specifically reserve that power if you've got the power anyway.
Well, your issue, though, is I assume the routine issue, the issue of the First Amendment, that these people were terminated because of their political affiliation.
We have two claims. One is the First Amendment claim, you're right, and the other is the due process claim. And to return to the First Amendment claim, this court has taught that in order to establish a claim, the plaintiffs must show they engaged in protected activity, and that protected activity was a substantial factor in the decision maker's decision to get rid of them. I've already discussed Squire Lance's statement, which is direct evidence of political animus. In addition to that, Diaz's exit interview form gave as a reason for her termination, new administration.
Yeah, but Brown stated in her deposition that she knew the plaintiffs had highly confidential positions, but did not know what kind of campaign work they did for Patinsky. Isn't that a problem?
I don't think it's a problem, because I think it's clear from her statements, both through Squire Lance and from her correspondence, which is noted in the record in response to supporters of Fahey Millennius, she indicated she wanted to put her own people in. Now, had the plaintiffs been properly in positions for which they could be subject to political termination, that would have been fine. Plaintiffs weren't in that position. And her indication that she wanted to put her own people in indicates that she knew and she thought they were her opponents. And she thought that, and I think we can, a jury could certainly infer from Squire Lance's statement, she thought that because they'd been associated with Clerk Patinsky and therefore were opponents, political opponents.
Well, Patinsky did, there's some confusing things. Patinsky didn't run for re-election.
That's correct.
So she wasn't a defeated candidate.
That's right.
I didn't understand the political affiliation, but apparently she was a Democrat and switched or something.
At one point she was a Democrat. She switched to run as a Republican, I think, in 1997. That's correct.
But then there was some talk about these people worked for her before when she was a Democrat. I don't understand the political affiliation. Mm-hmm. It sounds like more of a personal affiliation, isn't it?
No, in fact, it isn't. They were campaign workers for her, and I think as you know...
Did they campaign against Brown?
They did not campaign against Brown, but it's clear from Squire Lance's statement that she viewed them as opponents. I mean, because of all of their associations with Clerk Patinsky, they thought, he thought, they were Republicans who wouldn't be loyal to her.
What if she were just, didn't engage in politics at all and just worked there, and Brown came in and said, I got campaign workers and I want to give them a job, and so I've got to displace these other people who...
Well, our position would be that would be illegal, because she would be forcing people, incumbents in the office, to basically demonstrate their loyalty to her at the expense of getting pushed out for someone else.
I see. So someone who's just neutral or completely doesn't bother with politics, they would still be protected from being displaced by someone who was a political loyalist?
I think that's correct. Of course, that's not the situation we have here.
Well, I know you're going farther than that. You say she, and in fact, you have to show that Brown knew this.
Right.
And that she did make that decision based on their political affiliation.
And I think the record establishes that she knew, or you can certainly infer that she knew, basically because of her own testimony, that she was getting rid of the plaintiffs to put her own people in through Squire Lance's testimony, and because she had no other reason to get rid of them. And she said job performance had nothing to do with this. I wasn't reorganizing. There's not a budget issue here. She had no other reason. Defendants have admitted that they were aware of the plaintiff's close association with a former clerk. They've admitted they were aware that they'd been charged with carrying out Clerk Patinsky's policies and her agenda. They were active in campaigns. In fact, the plaintiffs were all placed on a hit list, slated to resign as of the end of January, prior to the time Clerk Brown took office.
That was prior to the time she took office, and who made that hit list?
Who made
the hit list? You said
all three plaintiffs. You mean who drafted?
Yes.
Well, that is subject to dispute.
Right.
So either Clerk Brown or a couple of her associates.
Right. But that you haven't been able to specifically tie that to her.
Or
she doesn't admit that she drafted it. I mean, because she says she didn't even know they were political campaign workers.
Right. There is testimony from one witness that Clerk Brown told her to put the names on that list. And Clerk Brown said she didn't say that, so there's a disputed fact as to that issue. It should go to the jury. The district court never addressed the nature of plaintiff's positions because it found that plaintiffs hadn't established political motivation. The record's clear that the plaintiffs were not occupying policy positions. They were basically in positions where they could exercise no discretion, had no input into policy. That's what their supervisor said. There's a full record of this. The district court did not reach this issue. Nevertheless, they were not in those positions and were not subject to political motivation. And I see my time is up. I'll reserve some time for rebuttal.
You have a little bit left. Okay. Mr. Quinlan?
Your Honors, may it please the Court, my name is William R. Quinlan on behalf of the defendant, the clerk, and the and Mr. Squire Lance. Excuse me, I have a bad voice and I'm trying to speak up. Counsel would like you to believe that this is a typical political firing case where all of the assertions that she has suggested have been admitted, and we have a situation where people were terminated because they had conducted political activities on behalf of the prior clerk, who apparently is to be considered an adversary. Ironically, if we look at this, the actual facts, the prior clerk supported Clerk Brown, as did these people who were now discharged, also during the election, supported them. There was no adversarial position here, since they all were involved in elections at prior times, and they were never adverse to Clerk Brown. And so that there isn't that particular necessary ingredient which must exist. And the fact of the matter is that all of these people occupied exempt positions the entire time that they worked for Clerk Puchinsky. And in fact, when they came into the new jobs that they were giving, these jobs in and of themselves, by their duties and responsibilities and the nature of the position, are clearly exempt positions.
They are just mislabeled non-exempt or whatever you call
them. They just call them non-exempt. And in one instance, it was done by a letter that suggested, it was done by Mr. Strolka, who was the political aide for Clerk Puchinsky. He wrote a letter saying that she had decided to make these now non-exempt. Just a letter, that was the basis for it. Another was that Clerk Puchinsky, of course, by affidavit, had suggested that these things, you know, were not those type of jobs, etc. But as the court knows, those are not a basis upon which you can establish your burden, and that is the case here. The fact of the matter here is that there was no genuine material issues of fact that the plaintiff did not meet their burden of stating a prima facie case, establishing by a preponderance of the evidence that the First and 14th Amendments were violated. They just didn't do it. They failed to establish a prima case warranting First Amendment protection. It was plaintiff's burden to establish by a preponderance of the evidence.
Well, if it wasn't a termination for political reasons, what was the reason?
Well, what was done was the clerk did come in. When she came in, she conducted an evaluation of all the positions in the office, and she went through and then looked at each position, and not the individuals who were in it, but the positions, to determine which positions were in fact positions that should be exempt and which positions were ones that should be non-exempt. That is, ones that had a category where you would be talking about people exercising discretionary decisions and participating in the decision-making process of the clerk's office.
Was this based perhaps on a higher salary?
It is a higher salary as well, yes, that is correct.
So these are
high-paying jobs.
I won't call them the plum jobs. These are the jobs.
Better jobs.
People, good. These are the ones people would want and might, even if working in a campaign, might hope to get.
That perhaps may be true. It is the better jobs in the office, but all of these jobs were jobs that had responsibilities, did involve discretion, and as you read the descriptions of these jobs, you can see that they were all important jobs within the clerk's office. And the clerk did do an analysis and went through, and she then made a list of what all of these positions were, which would be exempt and which should not be exempt. Now, that's exactly what Clerk Puchinsky did. She changed it four different times, and all closely at the point of where she was leaving office that she changed these positions. And the positions were changed. Originally, there were some 114 exempt positions, which would be what you'd call your upper staff or your high staff people who were your people who worked with you.
114 out of what?
2,300.
Okay.
And it was reduced down at the end, by the time that Clerk Puchinsky left, to somewhere around, I think it was under the 50s. So what she looked at when she came in is that she had a very limited number of top staff positions in an office with 2,300 people that spread out all over Cook County, and looking for people who would be, if you will, or higher echelon people who would be people that she could count on, that made decisions, represented her, and to do the things that she does on her behalf in these particular offices around the county, and in more important offices in the main office itself. And that's exactly what she did. And as she went through, she evaluated the positions, didn't look at who was in the positions, but evaluated the individual positions.
Mostly from the people she wanted to put in, as opposed to who was going to get kicked out?
No, she looked at it from the point of view of, what positions do I need to run this office as a manager?
In other words, you need certain positions to put, I assume she had some idea of who she was going to put where. Who she needed in her... I mean, she's not going to take applications off the street, I assume.
You know, in some cases that may be true, where they actually do. But what she was looking for, rather than looking for where to put people, She was looking for what jobs were the jobs that you needed to have as being executive-type positions.
Okay. Did this process include assessing who was in them and whether or not...
She did not assess who was in it.
Not at any point.
No.
Once she decided she needed those people were out.
Then she made the choice at that point to determine that those were people that she thought, because they were positions that would be exempt positions, which would be ones that did take into account a person's philosophy and background, because they were involved in making strategic decisions and participating with her in that particular type of capacity. And if you look at the manual specifically provides that the positions can be changed from time to time, and as they said, in the case of the old clerk, it was done 4 times, and with the new clerk coming in, this is the first time, and that's what she did. None of these people, she didn't even know half of these people, she knew of some of these people, she did not know what their political relationship was with the other people, and if you look at the political relationships that were suggested to be had here, these were by affidavits that said that they were known to be close advisors and close friends of the former clerk. Well, first of all, that was their own self-serving affidavit. The clerk has testified that she was unaware of any of their prior activity for most of the period of time. They knew that at one point that they had worked for her, but that was about all. And as we said earlier here in the part of the argument, is that they were adverse to the clerk in any of her positions. So the fact that she worked for the clerk and was a confidant of the clerk or worked in her campaign was not in an adversarial position to Clerk Brown, because Clerk Brown did not run against Clerk Paczynski, was not involved in any of those activities. Some of them involved suggestions of their political activities was that they had worked for Roman Paczynski, who was the alderman and the father of the clerk, some 10-15 years before that. And of course, that is not relevant, since it is not the current type of information. These things were remote at best, and they were no way related to any particular political activity. In fact, these things were so remote and so removed, it is most ludicrous to suggest that the clerk would in any way have been able to base that activity on any constitutional deprivation, because these things had occurred previously, they were not ongoing. The fact of the matter is they weren't adverse, and she testified that she didn't even know the positions that these people had and what they had. But the real thing here is, in fact, that even any of these activities they performed were nothing in relation to being adverse to the Clerk Brown, so that there was no basis here for suggesting that they had engaged in any constitutionally protected activity, first of all. They did not establish that they had any particular political activities or political affiliation. It was more of a generality. It was the type of thing. Some was organizing the St. Patrick's Day parade for the office. I mean, this was an event that occurred every year. It was a nonpartisan type of a function that occurred every year. They had some Irish delegates come in, and the clerk had the assistance of some of these people in setting that up, but that was like in a one-time occasion. Again, not a political activity, more of a social, governmental type of activity. So the activities at best were too remote in time, not adverse, and the only thing they really had to identify any of the activities they were involved in was the self-serving affidavits of themselves. And this, of course, is not sufficient evidence that could in any way be used to support the position of demonstrating that these were political activities or political conduct that was protected and it was not. And as indicated, you have to demonstrate, as your honors know, that it's their burden to do it. And the fact that protected activity even precedes a termination does not create an inference, but it was actually motivation. The plaintiff's burden to prove that it was the motivation for firing or discharging these people.
What about Squire Lance and what he said?
Well, Squire Lance's comments is, and the record will show, that he did not have any ability to make any decision about terminating people. He did not make any decision about who was exempt. That was solely and exclusively within the clerk. He made those observations, and he said that he had said that to the committeemen. I don't know if he said it to report was a fact or to try and make him feel better that his person was not being kept on and that, well, this was just a change in power here. It was a political type of thing and that. But if we look at the Nounce case, that case, as your honors may recall, involved a situation with a change of attorney generals in Indiana. And that was a situation, again, where the individual who was the chief of staff had told him that he was being discharged for political reasons and he was being let go. And the court there found that is not to be something that one could rely on, the fact being that it was really speculation at best, because he was a non-decision maker in that. The attorney general had chosen to discharge the individual, and the situation, I think, is exactly the same here. The fact of the matter is, whatever Mr. Lance may have said or not said, he was not the decision maker. He was not involved in that, did not have the authority to make those decisions, and what he suggested was really his speculation or his assumption, or as they say, maybe he was trying to be, quote, political in the small p sense of the word, trying to assuage the concerns of somebody who had supported an individual for a job and didn't get to keep the job.
What about the clerk doesn't know the person that's being replaced, but she does know the person she wants to put into the job, and that person is politically affiliated and a loyalist and going to be a policymaker or whatever you want to call them. Is that okay?
Absolutely. That Rutan case specifically so provides, Your Honor. It's a situation, if it is a confidential position, is considered to be what is exempt. And confidential is a policy making. You participate in policy making.
So are there as many as over 100 of those?
Well, one time there was. I don't know the exact numbers. She came back to put these positions back in, and I frankly, and I apologize, I don't know what the number is at the present time, but they were down as low as under 58, and that was at the end of her term. But of course, as you see what was taking place, she took the people that had been exempt in her administration and then tried to place them by creating a similar type of jobs, but making them, quote, non-exempt, so that they would be protected from any kind of termination by somebody who would like to put their own people in it. But the problem was the positions that were created and the positions that existed and the positions that were used by Clerk Brown were positions that, frankly, were confidential and policy-making positions, did continue to be that, and all they did was change terminology, gave them a new job with the same kind of duties, and gave them a similar type of pay. So what was done here, and honestly it was admitted, that what she was trying to do was to protect these people so that their political jobs would be continued with the new administration, because she changed the title of it, and she would declare these to be non-exempt positions. And what the clerk did was she went back and looked at the jobs to determine what legitimately ought to be exempt positions in her administration. And that would be the same with whether it's Republican, Democrat, nonpartisan, whatever it might be, anybody.
Does the office holder in Cook County make the decision his or herself as to what positions are exempt and what are not?
Well, frankly, it does not have any power of law outside of the clerk's office, because the county government is an unusual structure. It is set up with the county board and the president of the county, who is the chief executive officer. But because you also have constitutional elected officers, they are what you call independent officers who run their own office, if you will.
Ordinarily, civil service jobs are, you don't get the risk of losing your job, but you don't make as much money. The exempt positions, you make more money, but you might go out when the new administration comes in. Constitutionally elected offices sort of run that way?
Unfortunately for the idea of if you're the chief executive officer, such as the president of the county, your cabinet really is not under your control. Most of those are independent constitutionally elected officers, and the only thing you control is the budget. So that in this instance, it would be under the clerk, and the clerk would be able to, by the policy manual, make these kind of determinations. Now, pay raises and things of that nature and grades is controlled by the county's Department of Human Resources, in the sense that you have to have consistency for budget purposes. But she may appoint people into the budget positions that she calls them by title, whatever she may wish, as long as it fits into a budget position. And that was what the grades were that were mentioned in here. They, as you can see, some went from an 8 to like a 20. That's a lot of jumps in pay, and that's what this was about. Your Honor, I don't mean to suggest this is anything light or anything of that nature, but it is common practice. The law was followed. it is recognized as something that is done in public office, and in fact it is allowed to be done and is necessary to run the office. I see my time is up.
I just want to ask one question. Do you agree with her in terms of her interpretation of the handbook, that these positions were contract positions, that we can infer that they are based on some contract or some agreement?
Actually, the law and the agreement is to the contrary. And
your interpretation of the disclaimer language is that it is what it says.
It is what it says. It is straightforward, and it does say that right at the very beginning of the book. It says it clearly, and it says that there is no promise here of any kind of employment, no contract, and it may be changed.
All right.
And that's exactly what it says, and that's, I think, it means. Thank you, Ron.
Okay, thanks. Gary, you've got about a minute, I think.
Briefly, it is a disputed fact. Lance's participation in the decision, it's one thing for counsel to say he had nothing to do with it. I think the evidence shows he perhaps did have something to do with the decision to terminate the plaintiff. After all, he was second in command. He was in charge of human resources. He was directed to handle Fahey Wallenius's appeal. There's at least enough here for a jury to decide what Lance's role was and what weight to ascribe the evidence that the statement that he made. Counsel, with all due respect, I think traveled far from the record in filling in what Clerk Brown's motivation was with respect to these particular plaintiffs. Most of what he said, of course, isn't even in the record. And again, the jury is entitled to decide whether or not she was motivated by the plaintiff's political affiliation. She herself said, I want to put my own people in. In this context, it really can have no other meaning, especially with public employment, with First Amendment rights so important. The court ought to scrutinize the statement, ought to let the statement at least get to the jury for them to decide whether, in fact, she didn't want them there because of their former political affiliation. And I want to say one more thing with respect to the plaintiff's position. They weren't, their jobs changed. They weren't, Clerk Paczynski didn't suddenly say, oh, well, now you're my secretary and now you're protected. She said to them, you may look for other jobs that aren't in confidential positions. And if you find them and if you're qualified for them, you can have those. And they found them. It wasn't a situation where the same job duties were previously exempt and then declared non-exempt.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much.
That case will be taken under advisement.